Hi, this is writer-director Todd Haynes. I just directed the movie Carol, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Dearest, there are no accidents, and no explanation I offer will satisfy you.
I like that.
You seek resolutions because you're young. But you will understand this one day.
How many times have you been in love?
You're always the most beautiful woman in the room.
Therese Bellevet.
Carol.
Tell me you know what you're doing.
I never did. And then it changed.
She's still my wife. I love her.
I can't help you with that.
It shouldn't be like this.
I know.
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 329 of the podcast, the first episode of the year 2016. I hope this episode finds you well. I hope you had a great holiday season, no matter what holiday you happen to observe. I hope that you're well and our things are going well, you know. It's tough times for some people, and maybe the new year will bring in a sense of hope and inspiration for you. I know it has for me. And my commitment is to be more authentic, more honest, and do a show that's even better and, you know, keeps its humor and sense of whimsy. But also, again, does deliver something that's profound and important. I know it sounds a little heady, but that's kind of the way I feel. This is my way of connecting with people, even though it's sort of one-sided. But I do feel it. So thank you for tuning in for however long you may have been tuning in, and maybe for going forward for tuning into future shows. I can't think of really of a better way to start the new year than with this particular episode. One of my favorite films of the past bunch of months is the film Carol, directed by Todd Haynes, and starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, and with a supporting cast that includes Sarah Paulson, Kyle Chandler, and Carrie Brownstein, just to name a few. The film is being distributed by the Weinstein Company and is currently in a theater near you. It is, of course, hoping, I assume, to garner some awards over the next few months as we enter into the award season here. Todd Haynes has not really won that many major awards. I've been a fan of his. I first really discovered him a little later. I came from the music industry, so I didn't start really focusing in on independent film until about 10 years ago, a little bit before that, but I really started to really become aware of filmmakers like Todd Haynes. It was around the time of Safe when I discovered Haynes, which was, I believe, his second feature. He had made the short film Superstar, which was, this short film based on the story of Karen Carpenter and her demise through anorexia and her career. And he couldn't get the music rights from her surviving brother, Richard Carpenter, and so the film really just languished. But he went on to make a film called Poison sometime later, which was his first feature, and I would say it was pretty experimental in its approach. Poison came out in 1991, and the film was three different stories interwoven together. It established him as part of the new queer cinema. There was a new wave of films which ended up being called New Queer Cinema. Todd Haynes was definitely part of that. It was starting with Poison that Todd would start a relationship that would go on to this day with Christine Vachon, the producer and the founder of Killer Films. Together, they would go on to make all of Todd's subsequent features, including his second feature, Safe, starring Julianne Moore. On this episode, we are going to, in fact, talk to Christine Vachon in just a couple of minutes. That will be the first segment. The second segment is the screenwriter, Phyllis Nagy, who adapted the original work, which was adapted from a novel by Patricia Highsmith, who we know from The Talented Mr. Ripley, Purple Noon, The American Friend, Strangers on a Train, and so many others. Well, those are adapted films, but she wrote a bunch of novels. And we find out that actually Phyllis, who adapted the novel into the screenplay, had a friendship with Patricia Highsmith. And we're going to talk to Phyllis about that and about the book and about adapting it. And it's a great conversation. I should also mention that this is Christine, her second appearance on the podcast. I'm excited to welcome her back and to welcome Phyllis for the first time on the podcast. And if that weren't enough, everyone, finally on this podcast, after 328 episodes, I can now finally welcome Todd Haynes onto the podcast. So, well, it was a big deal for me because he's in that pantheon of filmmakers who I really, really have wanted on the podcast and who I consider among my favorite contemporary filmmakers. So thank you, everybody at the Weinstein Company. Thank you, everybody at PMKBNC. The publicity company, for helping me get Todd and Christine and Phyllis on the podcast. It's greatly appreciated. We were supposed to have Ed Lockman on, who is the cinematographer for the film and for several other Todd Haynes films, but it did not work out last minute, and I'm sorry about that. We hope to bring Ed Lockman on an upcoming episode, and I'll keep you in touch about that. But in the meantime, again, I'm very excited to bring you this particular episode of the podcast, our first in the calendar year of 2016. This episode is brought to you and sponsored by our friends over at the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. The Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival is going to take place in Bay City, Michigan, from September 22nd through the 25th. Right now, submissions are open. So if you are a filmmaker and you have yourself a film you're very proud of and you want to get it into a festival that's going to really, really appreciate and take care of you, I recommend the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. The early bird deadline ends on January 15th in only a number of days, but you will have the regular deadline, which goes on through March the 15th, 2016, and then a late deadline, which is on April 15th. Of this year. There are two ways to submit your film. One is without a box. The other is you can submit through Film Freeway. Both links are available if you go to hhmfest.com/info/submit-film. Please don't hesitate. Submit your film to this wonderful festival in the beautiful Midwest. You will be able to enjoy this lovely town. It's one of the most beautiful times of the year. I was a juror on the at the festival only a few years ago and had a spectacular time, and I'm hoping to make my way back to the festival really soon. So again, please consider the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. Let's go into the first segment of this very special episode of Film Wax Radio, and that is, of course, with the producer and founder of Killer Films, Christine Vachon. Speaking of Todd, met in school, right? You were both studying semiotics or something like that?
Something like that.
Last we tuned in.
Yeah, we were both at Brown University. I majored in semiotics. I think Todd did a split major of art and semiotics, both equally useful.
Well, apparently it was.
You know, it was. I'm more sarcastic about it, I think, than Todd is, and that's not really fair because it exposed me to an extraordinary number of films. and to a way of looking at them and talking about them and really kind of getting into narrative and identification in ways that absolutely informed all the work I did afterwards.
I don't suppose you have an example that's putting you on the spot, maybe?
I mean, an example is simply to start thinking about genre in different ways. And I mean, look, Todd's work manifests itself that way from the very beginning. I mean, you know, taking something like Superstar, for example, which I didn't produce, where he takes, you know, he decides to play with the identification, you know, our identification and our desire to identify. So will that go to the degree of we be able to identify with a doll, which is, you know, essentially it's has an immobile face. And the way he animated Superstar was the way a child would play with dolls, you know, with hands below the frame, moving them
around.
Right,
it's not even stop motion. It's literally puppet-like.
It's literally
manipulation.
Like when you see a child playing with dolls and...
Right.
This one talks, and then that one talks, et cetera. I know you can't see my hand movements, but
I got so caught up that I didn't even think about that.
Hopefully you get an idea of what I mean. Yeah. And the fact is that, yes, the Superstar begins, and people laugh in the first few minutes because it's hilarious to see Karen Carpenter portrayed by a Barbie doll. But then by the end of the movie, you can't believe it, a performance that Barbie doll has given.
Right, and also I think the laughter is this like discomfort,
right?
With what you kind of what you're talking about, and it's sort of like what am I?
But then in Poison too, you know, he was playing again with different genres, and what were the sort of like set tropes within each genre?
Sure.
Anyway, I can talk a lot about how semiotics informed
our work.
That's fine. I'll stop.
Yeah, no, I'm actually reading a book now called "Gay Directors, Gay Films," which somebody gave me because I guess I'm going to think I'm going to have the author on, I suppose, now that I'm talking about it. I guess it covers sort of five different directors, beginning with Pedro Almodovar, and which, you know, they talk exactly about what you're saying,
right?
Is that, you know, taking all the tropes and turning and sort of offering them up in a, you know, upside down in new ways, you know. So you met him and then have produced just about at least almost every feature, or not
we produced. I produced everything with him since Superstar.
You have.
So that means Poison, Safe,
right?
Velvet Goldmine. Mm-hmm. A great short film called Dottie Gets Spanked.
I remember that.
Far From Heaven.
And the redo, the television.
And Mildred
HBO,
Pierce.
Mildred
I'm Not
Pierce.
There. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, mm-hmm. Carol.
Yeah. I guess that's what I'm trying to say is a lot of times when I find films that are period pieces or homages or, you know, kind of like what we're talking about to Cirque or whomever, is that they lack sometimes that emotional, you know, because they get kind of caught up a little bit in production values and et cetera. But by the end of this, I was really very moved. And so I guess I'm wondering what was the component of the story that was, if there was one, that was just so important?
I mean, I think that, you know, when we got the script, I was very familiar with the book, although I hadn't read it in some time. But
Price of Salt, right?
Price of Salt or Carol. I actually, when I read it, I think it had just been re-released. It came out in 1952, and then, but under a pseudonym.
Okay.
And then it was re-released in 1990 with a foreword or an afterword by Patricia Highsmith herself.
Okay.
You're going to be talking to Phyllis, right?
Yeah.
So she's, you know, she's the one to talk to about all this.
Oh, yeah, well,
she's a wonderful wealth of information. She knew Patricia Highsmith.
Right.
So everything I say, you can...
Fact check with her.
Yes. No. But so I read it, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. When the script came to us... I think Todd was very taken by the fact, of course, that Cate Blanchett was already attached, which just was this,
incredible,
you know, kind of a lightning rod for the story, but also how the script was such a beautiful interpretation of the novel, which is somewhat clinical, and the script manages, I think, to take from the novel which is almost like a dissection of falling in love for the first time in a way, you know, like every single step and what you go through in a way that when life is breathed into it, both in the screenplay and then in Todd's direction, it's devastating.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think that makes it so fascinating, actually I'm cracking up a bit because Todd had to appear on Good Morning New York on Fox this morning. Uh-huh. And of course, you know, that's not the most highbrow. And they were like, so is this a lesbian movie?
Yeah.
And
they're known for their subtlety, if nothing else.
Exactly. So Todd, of course, was very, you know, one of the things he touched upon, which I love to touch upon, is that the thing that's so, also so exhilarating about the movie and the script, I think, is how Therese and Carol, they didn't even have the language to discuss what was happening to them. Like, it wasn't even part of their world.
Right, right, right. It had entered the lexicon.
Right.
Especially for Carol, who comes from a very wealthy circumstance, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, where they probably just didn't talk about anything like that in there. Well, also, you mentioned first falling in love the first time, and I wasn't sure if Carol, if that was her. I think she was in love with her husband.
Look, I think that's open to interpretation, But you're really, you know, you begin the movie so much from Therese's point of view, and then towards the end, it shifts.
Sure.
So yes, Carol may have been, and maybe Carol was in love with Abby.
Right. Yeah, and also what I found so different or unpredictable about it was the men in both Carol and Therese's lives. You know, they were upset that they were losing grasp of the women they loved, but the lesbian aspect of it didn't seem to be the crucial.
Well, I think it was in Harge's case.
Was he more humiliated, do you think?
I don't know. Maybe you're right.
Emasculating for him?
Well, he certainly used it as a way to deny the thing that he thought mattered most to Carol. Would he have done that if she'd fallen in love with another man? He may have done the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Was this just switching gears a little bit. Was this a hard film to get made?
Yes. I mean, it came to us with some financing in place. It was the project was originated by a British producer named Elizabeth Carlson. And she and I have worked together before. We've known each other for many, many years. We made a film for HBO called Mrs. Harris together that Phyllis wrote and directed.
Wrote. Yeah.
So these are all like family. You know, everybody knows each other.
That makes it a lot easier.
But Liz had put together a fair amount of the financing and had attached Cate Blanchett and had attached another director. And then literally she called me to commiserate, to complain. I mean, we are close friends and we speak, you know, I'd say almost every day, often just about like, oh, this horrible thing happened to me on this film, or you won't believe what this lawyer is trying to, you know, the usual bullshit that that producers complain about to each other. So she called me to say, I think we've lost our director on Carol.
Uh-huh.
And I can't believe it. Like, it looks like we're about to, like, be able to pull it together. I've been working so hard on this. And I think we're going to lose him, and I'm about to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I said something like, well, you know, the movie I thought we were going to make with Todd this fall isn't going to happen either, or something like that. And then one of us, there was like a silence, and was like, why don't we show it to Todd?
Yeah.
So, I don't know if that was the question you asked.
It was a difficulty because you did bring Cate Blanchett into it from the beginning, so that must make it a lot easier on some level.
It makes it a little easier, basically, there were two issues. There were several issues, I should say. Because the movie had been in development a long time, that just accrues costs. That's like, just think of like a Rolling Stone gathering moss, I suppose. Although I suppose it doesn't gather moss, but you know what I'm trying to say.
I'm not sure.
Like if it did, it just accrues costs that never get up on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then Todd is a very, very ambitious filmmaker, and so we knew there was a level of production that he wanted to make sure we were able to achieve. And he was working with people like Ed Lachman and Judy Becker and Sandy Powell. So it required a lot of figuring out. Like, originally we thought, well, we'll shoot it in New York because it takes place in New York. But 1950s New York really doesn't exist. And we didn't have on that budget.
2014 in New York doesn't seem to exist.
Exactly.
To be honest.
So we didn't have the means to create it.
Yeah.
That just was like, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So then we had to find a city that would lend itself in the best possible way, and that was Cincinnati.
Cincinnati.
So then it was really, look, in Cincinnati, shooting there added a level of production value that I can't quite quantify, because it wasn't just, oh, perfect building, perfect street. There was a lot of that. But it was also, they wanted us there, you know?
Sure.
And that's not always the case in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know how you feel when, like, Law and Order is on your corner again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they're on our corner a lot.
Yeah.
And somebody's telling you can't even walk into your own building.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati, they were like, cool.
Right. Right. You know? Of course. I'm sure they're just all too, of course. It's sexy. It's glamorous. It's, yeah.
And it was employing people.
And you have
big
stars here. Mm-hmm.
You know, and we were eating in the restaurants and using the hotels and hiring as much local crew as we could.
Yeah. Are there incentives and breaks and that kind of thing?
Yes.
From Ohio? And,
yes.
Yeah, another probably motive.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And even the cross-country trip, right, was just kind of staying pretty local, wasn't it?
It was all pretty local.
Yeah. So these are the ways one cuts or saves money or comes about things a bit economically.
I think also when you're shooting a period film, it's all about what you see. It's all about what's in frame.
Yeah.
I mean, look, any movie is about what's in frame.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm shooting a non-period film, like a modern-day movie, it doesn't really matter if I shift the camera over a little bit because this is all here and it's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
If it's period, every inch has to be considered and dressed. We always say you pay by the yard. So if a director is very good at having a keen sense of what he or she needs in the frame, then you know you dress this, but not that and not that.
Did he have any, once he did bring it to Todd and he was available and he was obviously very turned on by that project, did he have any second thoughts in terms of doing another period piece, another melodrama, you know what I mean? Like, in other words, this was after a couple of other projects.
You know, Todd tends to not, he tends to really go with what he wants to do. And, you know, an agent said to me, an agent who thought he shouldn't do Carol, not his agent, said to me, but you know, if he does Carol after Mildred Pierce, people are going to start seeing him as a woman's director. And I'm like, God, that would be terrible.
Yeah. And it was...
OMG, you know.
And it was such a, obviously, a failure for
George Cukor
was considered in Douglas.
Vincent Minnelli.
Minnelli. Yeah. And what, I guess Cirque.
Oh, I would say Cirque. I mean, yeah. Cirque had Rock Hudson,
certainly,
too. But,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, but he made films about strong women.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now the it's a rollout now, right? It's a continual
yes.
roll. It's going wide, the film. Is that that's what's happening right
yeah.
now? So it's going, and it's played in Cincinnati, I assume, already, or it hasn't?
It had a premiere in Cincinnati for the local cast and crew, God, right before Christmas. But I don't know if it's actually opened there yet. I'd have to look at my sheet of theaters.
Mm-hmm. So, but it's going to how many? Do you know how many cities it's?
That's really a Weinstein Co. question. We're going to have a meeting about that tomorrow.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. So it's in the. It's sort of still in the.
Right now, it's I think in about 160 theaters. So it's going to go wider, maybe after the Globes.
And I guess that leads to the next issue is grappling with awards, and I mean, I guess that's important for a film like this where it really just It just brings more attention. Obviously, brings more attention to the film. And what's involved in doing that?
You know, look, I've brought a movie through an awards season several times,
mm-hmm.
and it's always kind of extraordinary because you know to thread that needle where. The critics like it, the public likes it, people want to see it, you know, where you actually get all the way there,
mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're at the table,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to the Golden Globes on Sunday night, and you get to sit in the room instead of, you know, at the viewing party, you know, it's extraordinary, and I'm grateful for every second of it. it is running a marathon. I mean, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of, you know, press, being out there, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a gift.
Sure.
And look, Todd has, I think Todd is one of the most extraordinary directors of his generation. We've worked together, God, close to 30 years probably at this point. And he never makes the same film twice.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never been recognized. And I would be over the moon if he was recognized this year. He already has been, obviously, by the Hollywood Foreign Press. Can't take it for granted. Who the hell knows, you know?
Are you speaking also somewhat for him, too? I mean, I know he's not, you know, complaining and whining about not getting a Golden Globe for Best Director, but I wish I could ask him directly, and hopefully I'll have that opportunity at some point. But is that something that he would find to be important for him?
I mean, look, I don't think there's a director in the world who can say with honesty that they don't care about the awards. Maybe Woody Allen, I don't know. But I also think at the end of the day, you know, he's not in it for that.
Uh-huh.
It would be great, but he's not in. He didn't make Carol to go to the Oscars.
Yeah, but I guess it all helps to lighten some of the pressure. Or
sure,
I don't. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know, because then you also have new pressures or new.
I don't know. You know,
like in terms of, because it's, you'd think after 30 years of filmmaking, you're having less of a struggle, but you know, the Todd Haynes of the world are still having difficulty.
Well, he is and he isn't. I mean, I have to say, for the past few years, I mean, look, Carol's budget was what it was. Uh-huh. We managed to make a fantastic movie with it. He has, I wouldn't paint him as a guerrilla filmmaker at this point. I mean, he has an extraordinary number of choices. Mm-hmm. He's very deliberate about what he wants to do. And he will never do something because somebody says this would be good for your career.
Understood.
That's right. Just not his MO.
You just said that given the budget, you made a beautiful picture and, you know, it looks great. That's you, right? That's Killer Films.
That's a combo of Liz Carlson, Killer, and the amazing, you know, Ed Lachman, Judy Becker, Sandy Powell, who are able to really be inventive with limited resources.
Yeah, Sandy's the...
Sandy is the is a legendary costume designer.
Costume designer, of course. Okay, so, and Judy Becker is the production designer.
That's right.
Yeah, Ed Lachman is the cinematographer.
That's right.
But Killer Films, what do you find is the, I guess, sweet spot, or what is the, you know, the thing that you guys can really offer a film or a filmmaker that,
well, it depends.
That is...
Every movie's different.
Sure.
With Todd, I think it's our very long, close relationship.
So like maybe a language that you guys share. And,
yeah, like you just said to me, are you speaking for him? And I can say, well, you know, not. I don't really speak for anybody but me, but I can pretty much tell you what Todd would say.
Yeah.
And so it gives Todd, to have us with him on a film, gives him a level of comfort and security that makes him feel like he can go forth, you know, and do his best. On some other movies, sometimes when we're working with first-time directors, it's about helping them prioritize, helping them get the best technicians for their particular vision. Sometimes on those movies, it's about convincing cast that help the film get financed that these people are the real thing. You know, which is always the trick with a first-time director is, you know, why should I do this, you know, if you're a big actor or even not a big actor. So every movie, it's a little different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just coming in and assuring everybody that there's some adults in the room.
And I don't know if this was the case with Carol, but are there times where you get even, like, amazing opportunity for casting somebody brought to you, and then it's, well, I don't think that's going to work.
I mean look, we meet with extraordinary actors all the time.
Sure.
And, you know, of course there's situations where an agent says to us, this actor is interested in your film, or I feel like they would be if you brought it to them. And that's not who the director wants, and that has to be handled, you know, in the most sensitive way possible. But all of that said, you know, everyone knows the kind of business we're in. It's a creative business. It's a, but it's a creative business. It's a business. And, you know, Todd is as aware as anybody that there are casting pressures on his movies. But he also loves to work with great actors and loves to, you know, he's, that's not a challenge that he's afraid of. You know, there's some, you know, some directors are able to work, you know, to bring extraordinary performances from lesser known actors. Todd is certainly is one of those when the budget allows us to do that.
Well, Carol is now in, I know, and obviously playing in how many cities did you
160,
say?
160 theaters, I think.
160 theaters, right. In however many cities,
right.
Major cities. And it's going to obviously go even broader.
It's going to go all the way, I hope.
All the way, yeah. And stars Cate Blanchett, Rooney Mara.
Kyle Chandler.
Sarah Paulson, of course. And who plays, oh, Kyle is plays
Harge.
Harge. He's fantastic in the movie, I have to say. I've seen him, I guess, on TV. I've seen him in a number of films, but... I mean, I got, this is obviously him, and it's Todd, but it was a character that really kind of surprised me, you know.
Well, I think one of the things that Phyllis did was she brought a lot more sympathy towards Harge.
A lot, yeah.
In her script, and I think Todd augmented that in his direction, because Patricia Highsmith's kind of, like, hard on him. She doesn't, you know, she's basically, he's fairly one-dimensional in the novel.
Yeah.
But I think doing that brought a level, you know, of sensitivity to it that was really moving. It made his plight very moving as well.
Well, I mean, you know, this from being a kind of a one-dimensional, you know, right. or like character that's kind of acts as a device on some
right.
level to somebody who we can relate to and who,
absolutely.
Who is complicated and textured and nuanced and all that stuff, which is, I guess, you know, as a director, what Todd does really incredibly going back to, as you said, Superstar.
Yep.
And everything else. Killer Films is now how many years?
It's our 20th anniversary.
Oh,
well, it
is?
Just was. This is year 21.
Oh, okay.
2015 was year 20. We have 4 movies at Sundance.
Tell me.
We had our Amazon series greenlit.
Which is?
Z, the Zelda Fitzgerald story with Christina Ricci.
Okay.
Our 4 movies going to Sundance are Wiener Dog, the new Todd Solondz film.
Oh, that is it. That's I was going to ask you about if you were involved in Todd's the other
yes,
Todd.
Yes,
your
we
other
are.
Todd.
We hadn't been for some time, but we got involved in this.
Oh,
one
that's wonderful to hear.
Produced it with Annapurna,
uh-huh.
And it's terrific.
Yeah.
White Girl, which we executive produced, uh-huh. which is a young director named Elizabeth Wood.
Uh-huh.
And the movie's fantastic. It's in the dramatic competition.
White Girl.
Mm-hmm. Goat. Which mm-hmm. we produced with Rabbit Bandini, which is James Franco's company,
mm-hmm.
That was directed by Andrew Neil, and from a script that we originally developed with David Gordon Green a million years ago.
Oh, okay.
So this has been a long time. Yeah, I probably can't afford David Gordon Green now. But,
oh, now he's working with Sandra Bullock and all that. You know, he's
but, you know, he also executive produced this movie, and he was really
I think great. I read that, yeah. I was surprised.
But that one, that stars Nick Jonas mm-hmm. And Ben Schnetzer. And then the fourth one is Frank and Lola, which we executive produced, which is a premiere, with Michael Shannon and Imogen Poots.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So...
Those are the 4.
Those are the 4.
It's going to be busy. And I did have on Todd Solondz some years ago when his last...
Sure, he was very entertaining.
He was. And, you know, for me, these are my guys. I love
right,
these guys.
Right.
This is exactly the kinds of guests I want to have on. So I'm always... It's always a little bit frustrating. When
I bet.
That's my subtle way of saying, you know, you can...
I'll encourage him.
That's all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Feel better. And now, ladies and gentlemen, a conversation I recently had with Phyllis Nagy, who has adapted the novel Price of Salt, written by Patricia Highsmith. And you're going to hear the backstory, which is really fascinating and wonderful, about her relationship with Patricia and making this very fine film, which I believe will, of course, ratchet up many nominations in the next, which we'll learn about in the coming days. So here it is, my conversation with screenwriter Phyllis Nagy.
Therese Bellevet.
Carol.
Tell me you know what you're doing.
I never did.
And then it changed.
She's still my wife. I love her.
I can't help you with that.
It shouldn't be like this.
I know. If he can't have me, I can't see my daughter.
Everything comes full circle.
We gave each other the most breathtaking of gifts.
Phyllis
Nagy.
Nagy? Oh, is it true? There are so many ways to mispronounce that name. So,
yes.
And having a name.
And I enjoy hearing them all.
So I thought it was spelled N A G E
N A G Y.
Oh, it is N A G Y, right?
It's a Hungarian name.
No, oh, very good. So, where are your ancestors from?
Mostly from Sicily.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's one guy from Hungary,
and he brought the name.
And he was gone long before I was born.
Uh-huh. Right.
The Sicilian woman dumped him,
but took the name first.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Understood. I did go to the press conference. Was it at the was on Central Park, the hotel?
Here in New York?
It was
about
a month ago. Yeah.
Somewhere there.
At the Essex House or something.
That's right.
Was it? Anyway, so I should have noted the pronunciation, but everybody just says Phyllis, so.
Yeah.
And, you know, I should say I wasn't planning on asking a question because I just kind of was there to observe. And maybe I thought, okay, if somehow I run into Todd and he says, who are you? And I'll say, well, you know, I do this podcast and. Because I've been trying to get him on. I was bending Christine's ear about this, too, which I saved to the end, just so you know, I have a little class.
Okay.
I wasn't trying to, like, use the opportunity. This time I'm being less classy, obviously, but it came up. But I went to the press conference, is my point, and I thought, all right, I'm going to ask a question. And I asked it of you.
All right.
Remember? Anyway, you may have done one or two press conferences.
God, yes, I have, and they all blur. So, forgive me.
But my question was, and maybe it'll start to, synapses might start to pop a little. My question was, how in writing the screenplay and adapting the book by Patricia Highsmith, which was originally called The Price of Salt, but then later became Carol. You know, here's a woman who, as risking her motherhood on some level, it's a male question too, you know, how she still manages to come off very maternal, very loving, very sympathetic. Was that something you were keeping in mind?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of these stories, well, not that there have been that many stories like this to come across cinema screen, but those that have been told are mostly, in the mainstream, are mostly from a male perspective. And I'm talking about on script level as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what distinguished Pat's novel and what seemed absolutely key to keep through everything else was the relatively healthy psychological choices that women make in situations like this. Carol knows on some level that she may not be able to articulate that the healthy choice is to temporarily walk away.
Mm-hmm.
To get herself in order, to be the person that she must be in order to be the person her daughter needs her to be.
And psychologically survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the world, right? Because staying may have just sort of sabotaged.
Right. It's a hugely emotional choice. But it isn't a sentimental choice. The sentimental choice is to deny yourself your well-being.
And your authentic.
Your identity.
Right.
Your
authenticity.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a false choice, really, that Carol rejects. And she's not sitting at home, I imagine, going through all those steps. But in the end, she is a strong woman who makes the right choice. And because she does so honestly and with a minimum of histrionics, I think this is why people respond to her. Don't question the choice. I mean, obviously, there will always be people who question such a choice, and what I like to call the subject matter people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are able to take every bit of narrative impulse out of context and look at them only through
the prism of
their own,
of these conventions,
yes,
and that
exactly.
we are brought up with, and that
yeah.
but that can be very limiting. I see from the conversation and from my question and how I posed it at the press conference that as progressive-minded as I think I am, I think that I kind of still learned that something about myself, that I still have these impulses, like my son lives with his mother. I mean, he also has a younger sister that I'm just bringing this up as a case example,
yeah.
but I always felt like the son should live with the mother. I don't know. The child should live with the mother if there's a divorce. Just that's my instinct.
But that's the social code. It's
yeah.
It goes way back. We're not to be chastised for reaching into that deep psychological conditioned well. But when someone does make a choice that runs counter to that, it's natural that the questions be asked. I mean, the film, the script, the performance, everything is asking you to ask that question.
Mm.
And hopefully most people in asking the question learn something, well, not so much about themselves, but about an alternate window. It's like opening up another window onto the way that people survive. And if you think about just that, then it's achieved something, I guess.
I was also talking to Christine about the character of Harge, the Carol's husband, who they have obviously something of a tumultuous relationship, and how maybe on paper, Patricia's novel, he's a little bit more one-dimensional. That's not meant to criticize. Better way to say it is less three-dimensional than comes in the movie. And I wonder if kind of making Harge more fuller, well-rounded a character, more sympathetic ultimately, because you know he loves Carol and he feels very rejected, and his instincts are very, very from personal woundedness. And with that, we kind of feel more for him at the same time. So we feel like here's a sensitive man. He might be internalizing his sensitivity, but that makes him maybe a loving dad. You know, we see all this stuff. So we're less worried about this child.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, he all of these characters, it goes for all of the men. They, too, are just behaving the way men behaved at the time, and I dare say there are a fair number of men who still behave that way. But I think the difference between script and novel is that in the novel, of course, we're getting all of this information about Harge and Richard and, to a certain extent, Danny.
Richard is Therese's
boyfriend.
Right.
Danny is her friend, who is also a very different character in the book. But we're seeing this through Therese's unreliable narration, and I mean unreliable in the sense that she only has eyes for Carol. So of course, everybody else is going to come off badly in some way, and it works in the book. Obviously, I didn't feel a need to judge these characters, and I think that's key. If you present honest behavior. And don't feel like you're sitting up on a perch, or the opposite, which is to be afraid of making them engage in sometimes harsh, what would appear to be harsh or ugly behavior. If you're not afraid of either one of those things, I think audiences can generally empathize with a character. Also, those actors, I mean, particularly we're talking about Harge, as played by Kyle Chandler, also made choices that were not judgmental and not sentimental, but mm-hmm. deeply felt.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these characters are operating through love.
Yeah.
What love does or engenders in them. And sometimes it's extremely painful, as it is in the case of Harge's love for Carol, which seems everlasting in a funny way. Richard, Therese's boyfriend, I don't think he really knows what love is, but whatever it is, he feels it in whatever stage he's at. He feels mm-hmm. it for Therese.
Right, and he's calling it love.
Yeah. And you know, the net result of being rejected in his case is, I must say, an understandable anger. Not only is he rejected, but he's rejected for a woman,
mm-hmm.
which, yeah, must have been very strange to him, given his social circle.
Right, right. But he seems also to be not necessarily nonplussed, because I think they're both Harge and Richard are both very hurt and bewildered on some level by the choices that the women in their lives are making. But on the other hand, they're also not as judgmental as I expected them to be. They're not really being harsh on them in terms of being lesbians. Maybe they just don't have the vernacular for it.
They don't have the vocabulary. But yeah. Beyond that, I think it's a common sense thing.
Uh-huh.
When you're creating a character, there was something about these men that both of these women responded to. And maybe it's that innate lack of judgment of the time.
Right. True.
And so for me, that was just a common sense meat and potato character choice that makes a great deal of sense. It's not something that you necessarily see bleeding out on the page, because people don't talk about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm such a great guy. I understand you. I took you back when you went off with Abby, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's something about them that's inherently decent. And that didn't have to be the case.
That's a good way of putting it. I know you had a friendship with Patricia Highsmith. You knew her personally. I'm vaguely remembering some of your anecdotes where she was not in favor of actually adapting any of her books, or was it this particular one?
Yeah, no, she didn't like any of the film adaptations.
Oh, that's
what
it was.
Saw
like
of her
Purple
books.
Noon.
None of them.
I'm trying to think what
Strangers
she would have seen.
Strangers on a Train.
Strangers on a Train, and I guess
The American Friend. And there were lots of,
and they're
European,
all so fantastic. That's the beauty of it, or
yeah,
the funny part.
I know.
I love all three of those.
But I understand that from her perspective,
yeah,
especially the Hitchcock, really betrayed the original intention of her book,
mm-hmm.
however fantastic a film it is.
You do the best you can under the circumstances and the times.
I don't know what she would have made of this. It is interesting, as you were talking about Harge and Richard, to note that immediately after writing this novel, she wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley,
mm-hmm.
which features another prominent Richard in, and Richard is a name that she uses a lot throughout her work.
Mm.
And they're usually these hapless, somewhat callow golden boys.
Portrayed by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Was that Richard, or who was
Richard
in that?
No, Richard was Jude Law.
Jude Law's character.
Dickie, of course, Greenleaf.
Dickie.
Yeah.
What a great name.
Yeah. But it's interesting that she reserved a particular place in her dark heart for men named Richard.
Oh, no, I have to start reading, going back, I guess, and reading, so I can maybe uncover this mystery. So explain for those who don't know, which is probably most people, the circumstances of your relationship with Highsmith.
Well, I was a researcher, a fact checker for New York Times Part 2 magazines in the late 80s when I was a kid. Well, they were at the time. There were magazines like The Sophisticated Traveler or The World of New York, or there was a lot of them. I can't remember.
They were magazines. They were in the magazine, only it was like devoted to a particular
subject.
To carry ads.
Yeah, that's
right. A vehicle for advertisements.
I don't know if they have those kinds of things anymore.
Well, I think they do.
Yeah,
I think so.
Anyway, the editor of World of New York wanted to hire a mystery writer to do a walking tour of Greenwood Cemetery, in which there are some prominent people buried and a lot of gangsters and gun malls.
This is in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Steinways are buried there, and there's that great piano mausoleum. And it's quite a place.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Anyway, so I can't remember who they asked or they wanted to get to write this, but I think it was Ruth Rendell, and she wasn't here. She wasn't available. And I suggested Pat Highsmith.
Mm-hmm.
And who knew that she was in town here in New York at that very moment doing a book tour for a novel called Found in the Street, which is a rather good late Pat Highsmith novel that's set in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
Anyway, she said yes, much to everyone's surprise. And so they sent me, as a punishment, I guess, or a reward, to accompany her. I didn't know that she had such a strange and prickly reputation as a person when I went to meet her. But I quickly discovered that she was extraordinarily reticent and a little bit ominous. We took this tour of the cemetery together. She said almost nothing, but she got very excited when she came across the grave of Lola Montez and sort of grunted a few times and took her walking stick and hit the grave.
How old would she have been in the
80s? Her mid-60s.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Which was actually felt older than it does
now,
by our standards.
Yeah.
Because of people living longer.
And then we had to take this awful tour of the crematorium and put our hands in the ovens, and it was awful. Anyway, when we were finished with this tour, it was about 11 a.m. And outside the cemetery, she just took out a hip flask of something. And she said, "I don't know about you, but I need a drink." And she held it out to me like some kind of challenge.
Right. This was the test.
Yeah. So I took it was scotch, as it turned out.
Uh-huh.
And she invited me to lunch, which turned out to be 6 packs of cheap beer. And from then on, we were really very great friends. At first, great correspondents, because still in those days, there was no email.
No,
so you wrote letters. She was a great letter writer. Once a week, there'd be this exchange of letters. And then...
Where did she live?
She lived, by this time, she was living in Switzerland, and she was about to build and design her last, what became her last house. But I moved to London in 1992, and so we saw each other a lot more then, and she died in early 95.
So it, I guess a protégé of sorts.
But
it became friends. It balanced out.
I mean, she wasn't a
right.
She wasn't a dramatist, and she was just she was very generous to people that she thought were smart.
Right.
If there was a young woman, I don't think she had any relationships at this point in her life. But if you were a young woman she didn't think was particularly smart, then she could become the sort of Henry Higgins. let me take you under my wing, sweetheart.
Yeah.
Sort of person.
I'm not suggesting for a moment that you were in a relationship with her, because your relationship was a friendship, as you already described it. But did you see any parallels at all between your relationship with Pat's? I call her Pat, like I know her, like she's a friend of mine, and Therese and Carol's, in terms of a dynamic. Like, in other words, there is a balancing ultimately.
Well, yeah. No, because by that time, Pat was elderly, and there's always a sexual frisson between Therese and Carol, even when Therese can't mm-hmm. properly identify it. And in this case, it was more I loved her work, or at least the work I had read until that point. And so if there was any parallel, it was Pat mm-hmm. guiding me to the books that she thought I should read and love of her work, which wasn't notably The Price of Salt, or Carol, as it mm-hmm. was called by then. I don't think she rated it as one of her finest pieces of work.
Mm.
Now, whether that was because it was so intensely personal a book for her and she had to distance herself from it, or whether she really felt like this, she knocked this off in a fever dream and that was that, I don't know. But I do know that she did not want to really discuss it in depth. And so I didn't read it until mm-hmm. after she died. And it's interesting. I think I wish more people would read it. Not because I don't think I myself would put it within her best three or four books. But I don't think I would have done it, this adaptation, if I felt it was like Deep Water, which I think is her great, great novel. Carol left lots of room.
I see what you mean. Mm. Also, sometimes flawed works are, you know, they mean something different. They're
yeah.
just, and I don't, I mean, that's the problem with one of the problems, I think, in the way a lot of culture or society views art,
yeah.
making an art, is that we don't take into account the broader context of a career of work,
right.
a body of work,
yeah.
an oeuvre, whatever. I look at failures as being important. When I see a film, I you know, maybe seen the six or seven films, I'm much more forgiving because I'm looking at the context.
Exactly. And also I wish more people would read. What I'm learning over these months being out on the road with this is that not a lot of people who have reviewed it or talked about film in a significant way have read the book. Mm-hmm. I think there's an assumption that it's just a very faithful adaptation of this simple love story, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. The film is a profoundly faithful in tone and intent adaptation of this book. I hope Pat would have liked it. I know she would have loved Kate Blanchett in a particular way.
Yeah.
It was her type. Mm-hmm. And she would have loved Rooney Mara. Beyond that, I don't know. Mm. But certainly, it's a very different piece of work than the novel, and I wish people would read it.
Mm.
I mean, we don't have the advantage of it being a recent bestseller or
right.
a graphic novel or mm-hmm. any of the things that people tend to read.
Yeah. I came very close in trying to squeeze it in between seeing the movie and no, I know that this wasn't aimed at me. She made a facial gesture for those who wondering what letting me off the hook type of experience. But actually, no, I was because of the way I approach this kind of stuff that I do, I actually, you know, wouldn't be outside the frame. I can't read everything, but I you know, would have read it. I'm very curious to read it. It's just that I need more distance in a way just so I can approach it and really, you know, enjoy it, like, without keeping all those faces. And, you know, I saw the movie so recently, Carol, relatively. But I'm very curious to start reading her. And there are so many adaptations now. And most of them actually succeed on some level. You know, I haven't seen any really bad adaptations, though I understand Patricia Highsmith may have disagreed. I mean, there may be a couple out there I'm forgetting.
There are a lot of strange European television adaptations.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There was something with Malkovich that was kind of a...
Well, that was an attempt at one of the Ripley novels. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And I haven't
sure
seen
was...
the latest... there was one last year, wasn't there? Oh, Tremor of Forgery.
I don't remember the title. That's an odd thing.
That's a very good book. Mm-hmm. So I'm keen on finally watching that one.
Mm-hmm.
But I get it. I mean, you know, Strangers on a Train, those two men do trade murders in Pat's book.
Right.
So Hitchcock made of it a moral statement, which was the last thing that Pat was interested in. So that's why she would have hated that film.
I see.
I think if she put a few drinks in her, she would have admitted that it was quite a thrilling film mm-hmm. all by itself.
A little, again, the hip flask.
Yeah, exactly.
She should bring it into the movie theaters when she's seeing an adaptation of her own novels. I should have asked this at the very top because now I'm curious. You said, obviously, you did some fact-checking, et cetera, for the New York Times. So where'd you grow up?
New York.
You're in New York?
I grew up in the East, well, what's now called the East Village, but was then the Lower East Side, St. Mark's Place.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So yeah. you grew up in Manhattan in your formative years and everything?
I did, yeah.
Very good. Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
I mean, not that I would have, it might as well have been Iowa.
Right.
Because I was confined to a 2 or 3 block radius.
I see. Interesting.
School, church, mm-hmm. home.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, you mentioned, yes. And there is a bit of Eastern European, there's a lot of Polish in the East Village, right? And
I guess, in the 70s, there was more. There
sure,
were more.
Of course. Yeah, much yeah. more.
Ukrainian, Polish. I went to the Polish Catholic school down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now where do you live now?
Now I live in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Ridiculous place.
no judgment here. Well, thank you, Phyllis. It's delightful meeting you. And it was really nice talking to you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Last up here, everyone, is the much anticipated conversation with Todd Haynes. Todd, of course, went on after, making a Superstar, Poison, Safe. He also, and we spent probably more time in this conversation talking about other films than Carol because I figured he was so exhausted talking about Carol. So I kind of invited him to talk about other films and other things that have gone on in his career. And I think that went well, and it was probably a wise choice. So you'll hear him talk about everything from Poison to Safe to Velvet Goldmine, which came out in 98, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, which was a Dylan project he did in 2007, through Mildred Pierce, which was an HBO miniseries, and now to his current film, Carol. If you haven't had a chance to see it, please go and check it out in the movie theaters. It's such a delightful, moving drama. I mean, I just can't really say enough, and it looks spectacular. Also, my friend and FilmWax Radio guest, Michael Taylor, who is an editor, he did not edit this film, but his wife, who is the production designer, Judy Becker, did do the production design on this film, and it is production designed within an inch of its life. It looks like $1 million. It was all primarily shot in Cincinnati, but you wouldn't know it. It's supposed to take place in New York, but it looks fantastic, and they did a great job with this film, so again, I'm going to recommend you go see Carol as soon as you can. And we'll be back after this conversation with filmmaker Todd Haynes.
You don't even know her.
You can forward any of my mail to Chicago General Post. I paid rent through February. I had a little extra money saved.
For our trip. Our trip, Terry. And now you're... I don't believe this is happening.
I can't explain it. I just...
What? You got one hell of a crush on this woman, is what? You're like a schoolgirl.
I do not. I just like her is all. I'm fond of anyone I can really talk to.
Nice. You know what I think? I think 2 weeks from now, you're going to be wishing that she's going to get tired of you. And you're going to wish that you would never...
You don't understand.
Oh, I do. I understand completely. You're in a trance.
I'm wide awake. I've never been more awake in my life. Why don't you leave me alone?
Hello, Mr. Haynes. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
All right. I feel like I've already gone through the finish line because I've been doggedly pursuing getting you on this podcast. I do. I feel like it's a major... It's something of an achievement that this worked out. So anyway, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry it was so hard. Today was a little poorly planned. I haven't had a moment to pee, let alone break, let alone eat with interviews.
Well,
back to back.
Anyway, I only ask if you...
Let's go for it.
I only ask if you do need to go to the bathroom to mute the phone.
All right.
By the way, I don't know if you know, but with the last few weeks, maybe a few weeks ago, the Film Society had this big retrospective of Douglas Sirk. Did you know about that?
Oh, yeah, I did. I did, yes.
I don't expect with your schedule and with the release of Carol that you had a chance to get over there.
No, I wasn't around for it, yeah. But I knew it was coming. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there were some more obscure titles that I wanted to see, but, you know, with all the best of intentions, I guess. But, you know, it kind of transitions for me to talk about the kind of filmmaker Sirk was. And that you are, I was talking to Christine the other day, and she said that, you know, this idea of being labeled a woman's filmmaker, you know, like Sirk, like George Cukor or whomever, that there was almost like an aspersion, you know, that you know, if indeed you would consider yourself a woman's filmmaker or not, it's sort of beside the point. But I was kind of curious on your take on that, because she thought it was kind of ironic in a way that, you know, it should be considered almost, you know, something you shouldn't be proud of.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I'm totally proud of it. If it's something people say, and I would consider myself in some great following in some, you know, esteemed footprints.
That's true.
Of other great directors who are associated with films about women and women's stories. but it's not the only kind of thing I do obviously, but I have enough of a track record that I'm very proud of.
Sure. No, I understand that too, of course, because one wants to just sort of make the sort of films, I assume, that you want to make when you're inspired by something and not really concern yourself from a, I don't know, promotional or marketing concern, you know. You make films that move you. So Christine was kind enough to come on a couple of times, and I know you guys went to, what was it, Vassar? Am I getting that right?
We went to Brown.
Brown, excuse me. I'm sorry. Yes, Brown.
Yeah.
I knew it was wrong coming out of my mouth. And you studied semiotics, is that right?
Well, it just happened to be called the program, you know, as if we all know what that means in some clear, absolute way. Because the program at the time was called the semiotics program within the English department. It's now become a full-fledged department called Modern Culture and Media. But it was just a very new way of sort of approaching cultural criticism and looking at cultural production with the recent work and kind of perspective of you know, structuralist writers and Marxists and feminists and psychoanalytic mm-hmm. kind of disciplines that had defined a lot of the, you know, 20th century criticism. So I didn't really know what it meant when I stumbled into it. It was just the only place that you could make. There were film production courses of any kind at Brown, which were very few, existed at all. And the prerequisite for doing film production were these courses in film theory and cultural theory. But it ended up being a really remarkable, you know, exposure to this relatively new discourse and one that I think connected to my own way of seeing things mm-hmm. more than I ever would have known, you know, except for just the serendipity of just having an interest in film itself, and that's sort of where film happened to be couched. Because, you know, even today, film departments, if they exist at all in colleges, are they're in the theater arts department or in the art department. They're I think probably more rarely within the English department of colleges, but
well, that's
that
true.
Was sort of the nature of the beast at the time.
Yeah, I would assume though there weren't that many. I mean, I would assume given your age, probably the very late 70s is when you were attending Brown, and it's probably at the time there were a fraction of the film departments that there are now anyway, right? So
yeah, exactly. exactly. Yeah, I didn't go there till 1980. I took a year off, but I graduated in 79 and then went to Brown then a year later.
And then ultimately, by the way, went to you got an MFA at Bard, correct?
Well, I never did complete the MFA at Bard. I just started. It was a 3-summer program for people, a lot of academics who wanted to get an additional MFA, adding on to their other degrees, but who had academic commitments during the year. So it was a summer program. And I just did the very first of the 3 summers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That would have gotten me the MFA. And, I sort of figured I would just be someone who would teach, who would make my own weird movies and teach, you know, and like many great filmmakers have in the past. And had the freedom to make whatever they wanted. So I didn't have any real practical expectations for following into a career of feature filmmaking in the marketplace.
I'm not 100% familiar with the timeline, but had you made a Superstar by the time you got to Bard?
No, that was my project at Bard.
Oh, very good. Okay.
I brought the script to Bard that I'd written in New York, and that was my project. So I spent the whole summer just kind of making the sets and props, and I just spent the whole summer in miniature land, making the world of Karen Carpenter's life in tiny scale, Barbie scale, and then at the end of the summer, spent a week or however long it was, 2 weeks maximum, I don't think it was more than that, shooting it with a couple friends that came up.
What is your relationship, by the way, because I figure you may have exhausted, you're talking about Carol alone, and I'm devoting this entire episode with conversation with both Phyllis and Christine as well to Carol, so trust me, I'm no way short shrifting the film, which I really was moved by in that movie. But I guess sure. But I was wondering what your relationship with your other films are. Like, how much do they weigh in on you when you're working on something contemporary or looking back at films or talking about them? Do they still feel contemporary to you, I guess, is my question.
They do. They definitely do. What's great, what I'm, you know, I couldn't be more proud of is the fact that they kind of continue to have a life of their own as I move on in my own life and continue to make other work. And this year in particular, where Carol was getting a lot of great attention, although this has happened at different times in that as well, but I've had I had several retrospectives, and there was one year I just felt like I was just doing retrospective after retrospective, like I was some guy in his 80s, you know. I don't have that many features. but what's great is the films have a discrete, they attract a very interesting and unique following that is not consistent across the board. So there's people who just really totally obsess over Velvet Goldmine, and then there's people who really love Safe, and then there's people who saw Poison in the New Queer Cinema time, and it kind of meant something for that era to them. And then there's Dylan fans who love I'm Not There, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So what's really interesting is how they have created their own sort of discrete little audiences that have continued over the years.
Yeah, speaking of I'm Not There, did you know that, like, for instance, you'd have the rights to that music? I can't remember. Did you know you'd have the rights to that, to the music in that case?
By the time that sort of obsession came upon me of sort of rediscovering Bob Dylan, this was at the end of the 90s, I just started to read all of these biographies about Dylan and get into them at a sort of different level, I guess, than I had when I was a teenager in high school. And then sort of began to imagine this way of telling his story in multiple, and because of the accounts that kept being told about him, at the, particularly in the 60s, as this shape-shifting enigma who kept, you know, getting so deeply into one phase of his music and his cultural inspiration, and then sort of shucking it all, you know, and moving on to the next, chucking it all. And so I got the idea for the concept, and I really liked it, and I was really compelled by it, and I was continually, and I was still so inspired by him and the work. And it was also at the time where the bootleg series music was just starting to come out, right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
I was also, like, exposed to stuff that other people who were into that music were, that they'd never heard before. But I said to Christine, I said, look, you know, I have this idea for a Dylan film, but there's no way that we could do it without the real music. You couldn't do it with sound-alike music. It would be ludicrous. And because we'd had such a notorious track record with starting with Kieran Carpenter and then following through with David Bowie in getting source music for these films that related to their lives, I was more skeptical than ever with Bob Dylan.
I'm sure.
And she said, so I said, I have this idea, but I'm not going to, like, write it and go through all the work of doing it and researching it if we really don't have a chance in hell of getting the music, and I don't think we do, you know? And she said, look, let's just see what happens. Let's just take it a step at a time, and we'll see. Like, Jesse Dylan, Dylan's oldest kid, makes rock videos. I think he even had directed maybe a feature. I can't remember now. But he was in the film world, you know.
Yes.
And so she knew somebody who knew Jesse, and and through Jesse we got connected to Jeff Rosen, Dylan's manager, and we began the conversation. And so Jeff, who was very intrigued by the concept, said, look, write it down on a one-sheet piece of paper. You know, don't use the words Voice of a Generation. Don't, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The stuff that is going to immediately. He'll shut down immediately. Yeah.
Pretty, like, modest and, you know, nerdy, which it was, and obscure or whatever. And we'll see. He said it reminds me of Allen Ginsberg statement that described Dylan as a series of American archetypes and a collection of archetypes. And so I was like, okay, you know, I wrote this one thing out called Suppositions on a Film Concerning Dylan, and one sheet, and sent it to Jeff with a bunch of my videos, DVDs of my movies. He sent it to Dylan's, and, you know, Endless Tour, what's it called?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah, I think it is called. And that's what it is.
He went on the tour truck, and Dylan watched it. And within a month, we get the word back that Dylan had said yes to all, you know, basically said, sure. He's like, you like this guy, Jeff? And Jeff's like, yeah, I do. I think he's kind of good, you know. And Dylan, you know, Dylan's always been interested in kind of art movies and cool directors. You know, he's had an interest in like, he likes Fassbinder. And, you know, he's a cultured guy. Likes to expose himself to what's out there. And so I guess he really did watch my movies and found them to be interesting. So he just said, all right, let's, so I, they were like, basically like, yeah, you got all the rights to the music and the life rights.
Wow.
I still can't even believe it. I like telling the story because I have to keep reminding myself that it's true, even to this day. You know what I mean?
You almost forget.
Fairy tale.
It's like you just remember all over again. So it's kind of your, you know, it puts you in a great humor because you're just reminded, exactly. Oh, yeah, that happened.
That really did happen.
And not only did that happen, but didn't the soundtrack make it onto the bootlegs? Wasn't that one of the bootlegs? Or am I remembering wrong?
Well, no, this song, I'm Not There, that had never been released before. It did finally, the entire Basement Tapes collection of music finally came out, I think, last year.
Yeah, it was maybe the last bootleg, but I just vaguely remember
One of the more recent ones was, I think the most recent is all of 1965 and 66 recordings.
Yeah, something just came out like a month ago, but the one before, I think you're right.
Yeah, but before that, the Basement Tapes higher basement tapes recordings that came out, which are amazing. And you could get them through bootlegs, not through the official bootleg series that Jeff is remastering and releasing. But I did get them. The song is in the movie, the actual recording of that song, and a cover by Sonic Youth as the closing credits song was in the movie. But and it was on our soundtrack. Yes.
Okay. Because for some reason,
first
in my
officially released on the soundtrack.
Because in my memory, for some reason, I'm remembering that. Oh, by the way, as a footnote, I worked at Sony Music for quite a number of years, and you know, of course, Columbia is one of the labels and Legacy.
Sure.
That came out. That whole thing was happening when I was working there. So, and in my memory, I'm Not There was like one of the bootlegs. They released it as like just as one of the in the bootleg series. But I guess I'm wrong. But anyway,
it wasn't officially one of the bootleg series. That would have been novel too and cool. But no, because it included so many songs. We got so many amazing covers done by temporary musicians or combinations of musicians from the period who were doing new versions with younger artists. And, you know, really great, you know, variety of approaches to the music, so much of which we couldn't find a place for in the finished film. So the soundtrack was a sort of almost parallel compendium, production that paralleled the movie itself with all of these great covers. The only actual Dylan recording on my soundtrack of I'm Not There is his version of I'm Not There.
Well, too bad you didn't have the body of work to impress Richard Carpenter. Is that his name, Richard Carpenter? Anyway, but oh well.
I'm sure Richard Carpenter is a major Dylan fanatic too.
It's no doubt you can see the direct relationship. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know. Well, I'm going to first of all try to come to the Q&A tonight because at the Museum of the Moving Image.
Cool.
Because also Michael Taylor, you know, Judy Becker's husband, is a good friend of mine.
And, oh, God, I love that guy so much.
I know, isn't it? He's such a champion.
He's such a fantastic guy. I love, yeah.
Isn't he? I know. He's such a geek and also just a stand-up guy. And
he's such a geek and so cool at the same time.
Well, of course, right. That's being comfortable in your skin. So I just want to make the comment that, again, it's been a thrill, and I'm so glad we got to do this. And if I get a second, I'll introduce myself tonight, assuming I get my approved to come in and just stand at the side for the Q&A. But I look forward to it, Adam. Thank you so much, Todd.
Awesome.
All right, good luck with everything. Okay.
Ring them bells, ye heathen, from the city that dreams. Ring them bells from the sanctuaries, cross the valleys and streams. For the deep and the wide, and the world's on its side. And time is running backwards, and so is the bride.
Thanks, everybody. Listen, you know, if you enjoy this episode of the podcast or any other episode of the podcast, I hope by now you're a subscriber, you know, and I hope that if you are listening and you enjoy the show that you have taken the few moments that it takes to go to our iTunes page and give it a star rating and a comment. I know you haven't in most cases because there's only a small number of people who have, and I don't understand why my listeners are not doing me this kindness of just going over there and doing that. But it only really does take a couple of minutes of your time, and it would be like, you know, a belated holiday gift to your friend here, Adam, over at the Film Wax Radio podcast. I can mention a couple of things that are going to be coming up soon. One is in March, I will be doing a live podcast at South by Southwest. It will be either be on March, I may have these dates wrong, it'll be in that middle of the festival, around March 12th or 13th, somewhere in there. And I will have a specific date very shortly indeed. And so far we have Tim League, who, you know, is the founder of Alamo Drafthouse and Drafthouse Films and Fantastic Fest. And we have Scott Glosserman on the panel, who is the founder and CEO of Gather Films. And we're going to announce a couple of more guests really soon. But those are committed, and that's going to happen in March at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. So if you get a chance and you are considering coming to the festival, please let me know, and maybe we can meet, and please come to that event, because I need to get as many people there as I can. And also, if you're in the New York City area, I am going to be, looks very likely that I'm going to be curating a series at the School of Visual Arts. They have a theater in their East 23rd Street campus. I'll let you know more about that shortly, too, but it looks like I'll be doing a monthly screening there, at least through the next few months, with the beginning of February, and I will announce very specific information on an upcoming show. Speaking of upcoming shows, on the next episode of the podcast, returning Ross Partridge, his film Lamb, which he directed and stars in, is currently out in theaters as of today, Friday, the 8th of January. We will be posting that show sometime next week, when it will not only be in theaters, but it will also be available on demand. So as of January 12th, it will be on demand. So you will be able to appreciate seeing that. You can choose to see the film after you hear my conversation with my buddy Ross. We have been running into each other quite a bit. If we started off last year at South by Southwest, wherein I went to the premiere, and then I talked to him and his lovely wife, the actress Jennifer LaFleur, and we had them on the podcast. And then just the other day at the Apple Store in Soho, I moderated a nice little conversation for that podcast, which is done live there in the Apple Store. And Ross was there, as well as his leading lady, Una Lawrence, who is a very young actress, and she's, very talented. Very talented, and we had a nice time there at the Apple Store. And then the next day I went to meet Ross to do the podcast. And so I'm getting behind this film. Again, it's called Lamb. It's kind of a dark story, but it's also really, really exquisite. And I highly recommend checking out that film. That'll be on the next episode of the podcast. Also on that episode will be filmmaker Allison Bagnell, whose film Funny Bunny is also going to be available on digital platforms. Speaking of Funny Bunny, I think I actually also moderated her opening night Q&A in New York, in Brooklyn, at the IFP Made in New York Media Center, where they had theatrical for that film, Funny Bunny. It's really nice to have these relationships with these talented filmmakers. Again, put those on your radar. Lamb and Funny Bunny. And you know, these movies, there aren't as many animals in them as you think there are, truthfully, but it does sound like they're full of animals, but they're not, you know. That's the next episode of the podcast, episode number 330. So please do continue to tune in, and reach out to me on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio, or you can find me on Facebook as well under my name, Adam Shartoff. Also, I'm on Twitter at Filmwax Radio. We're on Instagram, also under Filmwax Radio. And you can go to the website, filmwaxradio.com, and email me through that, or just check in to see what's going on. But in the meantime, please do tell all your friends and family that love film about the podcast, and continue to engage with me. And it's all very much appreciated. This will be a big year. More news coming up, more things developing. Trust me, you have more announcements to come. Continue, please, to make great art out there, and let me know about it. Thank you so much for your support, friendship. Let's have a great year. In the meantime, this is your host, Adam Shartoff. The name of the show, Film Wax Radio. Until next time, take care.
Oh, it's rush hour now, on the wheel and the plow. And the sun is a-going down upon the sacred cow. Ring them bells, sweet Martha, for the poor man's son. Ring them bells so the world will know that God is one. Oh, the shepherd is asleep where the willows weep. and the mountains are filled with lost sheep. Ring them bells for the blind and the deaf. Ring them bells for all of us who are left. Ring them bells for the chosen few who will judge the many when the game is through. Ring them bells for the time that flies, for the child that